The Guardian.
V.
All I can say is that the responsibility for what is taking place rests firmly on the shoulders of Mr. McGregor and the National Coal Board. It is they who are closing pits. It is they who are sacking men.
My father still reads the dictionary every day. He says your life depends on your power to master words. Arthur Scargill, Sunday Times, 10th of January, 1982.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. My poet friends are always complaining that we don't do enough poetry, so we're devoting the whole of this week's programme to it. And not even to poetry in general, but to a single poet, Tony Harrison, a colossus of the rhyming couplet who has just turned 80. Here to help us vindicate this bold choice is Blake Morrison, himself a poet and memoirist and university professor and former literary editor. But equally importantly, perhaps, a Yorkshireman, born in the town of Skipton, some 30 miles as the Crake flies, that's Yorkshire for crow for those who don't know, from Harrison's native Leeds. Part of the inspiration for this podcast is a fabulous two-day celebration of Tony Harrison, which was hosted by the British Academy last week. Participants included the actor Vanessa Redgrave, the broadcaster Melvin Bragg, and the playwright Lee Hall, author of the hit musical of stage and screen Billy Elliot. We'll be hearing from them in a bit, a reminder that many of his greatest works have been for the stage and the screen. But Blake, you gave a masterclass in his poetry for the page, a much quieter sort of poetry than we're used to from him. Tell us a little bit about him and tell us how you came to know him and what his influence on you has been.
I came to know him probably late 70s, early 80s, when Andrew Motion and I were putting together an anthology for Penguin of contemporary British poetry. There hadn't been one for about 20 years. And I think both of us felt that two figures stood out. One was Seamus Heaney, who actually disputed being called British, as it turned out, rather than Irish. And the other was Tony Harrison, working class poet from Leeds, also a renowned classicist. And in particular, I think we were drawn to his elegies for his parents. He seemed to have reached a new level of achievement with those. These were Meredithian sonnets.
Now, tell us about this. This is really interesting. I'd never heard of the Meredithian sonnet before. And Sian, who is with us in the studio as well, I'm sure probably hasn't either.
No, I haven't.
Well, George Meredith wrote them in the 19th century for his Modern Love. It's a different form. It's 16 lines rather than 14 lines. Harrison says he likes it because it breaks nicely into two halves, the octet, and he thinks of it as a combative form, a dialectical form where you play things off against each other. And one of the things that Tony Harrison, I think, struck us as doing when we were anthologizing was bringing back rhyme, and very full rhyme. There'd been a sort of 20th century idea, you've got to go very light on your rhyme, half rhyme, incomplete rhyme. But no, Tony Harrison gives you full rhyme. He lets you know always the work that's gone into a poem. And I think that's all to do with his idea of labour. You know, that there's this idea that poetry comes naturally. Well, it doesn't. It's hard work. And he doesn't mind, if you like, claiming solidarity with his working class ancestors, the miners, the bakers, the railwaymen, by himself being a labouring kind of poet. Not laboured, but he certainly lets you know how much has gone into
it. He's reached for that rhyme quite strenuously sometimes.
He does, and he packs his poetry absolutely full of ambiguities and plays and puns and so on, and working on so many different levels. I think that's another reason why I'm so drawn to him.
Well, his 80th birthday celebrations were dominated by the generation who were with him in the late 1970s and 1980s, when he really did dominate the stage, didn't he, with adaptations like The Oresteia or The Mysteries. So I wanted to find out what he meant to a younger generation. How, for instance, did Lee Hall come to find out about him?
Well, before I knew his work, I come from Newcastle. My childhood girlfriend lived quite near Tony when she was growing up, and her parents knew each other. Anyway, he was supposed to come round at Christmas, and apparently every Christmas he would come round and sing Tennyson's Lady of Shalott to the tune of When I'm Cleaning Windows by George Formby, and this was a party piece he would do on Christmas morning. So I first met him in anticipation of him doing this literary party piece. But then I just started reading his work when I was up there, and was always amazed that this poet was writing a couple of miles away from my house. And just really, I guess I was saturated in Tony Harrison in my formative years.
And you when you spoke at the conference, you mentioned that actually you probably wouldn't have been able to do Billy Elliot without the example of Tony Harrison putting working class people onto the stage.
Very much so. I think that because I was from a working class background, probably quite similar to Tony's, but obviously a generation later, that a lot of the things he wrote about the dislocation of becoming educated and coming into culture, I felt really acutely. And I eventually went to Cambridge, and the first thing I did was sit on the college lawn. Somebody sent me V to read, and I read this, you know, very very powerful piece of work, and it spoke very directly to me. And I wanted to somehow write about my own experience, which was obviously 30 years later than Tony's. And it was just at the finish of the miners' strike that I went to college. And so the idea of a kid struggling in the Northeast to find a voice really. On that, on the first day at Cambridge, I knew I wanted to write something about it, and it was quite hard to find the right vehicle. And then a little bit later, I realised it was dance and not poetry, because it was a bit more interesting to watch on film than somebody penning poems. So literally, the seed of Billy Elliot happened on that day, my first day, and with Tony's poem. So it's really, really connected for me. Yeah.
Labour's Andy Burnham is also somebody whose life was altered by Tony's work. Here he is, talking at the British Academy event.
The exact point at which Tony Harrison changed my life was in 1987, when my mum and dad came home from a parents' evening and delivered this bombshell. Your English teacher thinks you should apply to Cambridge, and he wants you to go and see him tomorrow. When I did, he handed me an old VHS videotape with one letter written on the side, V. When I slipped it into the recorder back at home, it was a moment of great revelation for me. First, that it was possible for poetry to have a northern accent, a northern voice, and a mesmerising one at that. Until then, I'd assumed that there was some kind of law that poetry could only be spoken in some kind of Radio 4 newsreader home counties type voice. The second revelation was that poetry could explore subjects other than nature, aristocratic love, war, and deal actually with the thorniest of British subjects, class and all of the complexity that it brings, and specifically how education and the study of literature in particular takes you into a new world, in many ways a discomforting world if you come from a working class background, into a position of not quite fitting in the rarefied atmosphere of academia and always expecting the tap on your shoulder, as I did throughout my time at Cambridge. And at the same time, while not fitting into that world, it also has the effect of making you feel more distant from your mum and dad when you went back home from university, because you were now in a world of books and of letters, and they weren't. And though you didn't love them any less, you nevertheless kind of felt a distance had crept in. And that's why, for me, in Tony's work, I found incredible expression of the things that I was feeling. But he also gave me hope that it was possible to reconcile your roots with your new calling.
That was Andy Burnham. So if Tony Harrison influenced Andy and Lee, who were his formative influences? Melvin Bragg asked the famously curmudgeonly Tony if any teachers had been particularly important to him.
I did have a very encouraging teacher at the primary school called Mr. Jordan, who was interested in seeing that I could, you know, turn a rhyme or two. He didn't get over protective of the talent, but he said, "Oh, it's a good thing to do." I suddenly found I could. I thought I was doing it on my own, you know, or it was part of the life of the streets, and it wasn't what I was writing. I like the poetry of the streets. I love all those rhymes. You know, the one I'm always quoting, "Ark, ark, sound of thunder, must be Peasley, had last thunder, quick, quick, closet door, we're far too late, it's out at floor." Things like that. I mean, I learned my rhythms in the street as well, but I was trying to write things, and he approved of it. But I had mostly negative people in my grammar school, I'm afraid.
But were you still writing poetry at the grammar school?
Yes, yes.
And at the same time, what we get from your writing is that the thing that you were determined to do was to get on with learning. And Me, Tarzan, the poem where you won't go out to play because you've got to finish the essay, and so on and so forth. What drove you to that? That you were so determined to stay in when your friends are out there playing?
I think it's in my poem, Heredity, that I wrote after The Misanthrope that was on at the National Theatre, and I heard somebody in the audience say, "Oh, he has such a command over language." And they say he comes from Sheffield. And so I wrote the Heredity poem. Where does it come from? My mother would say, where does it come from, Artone? And I wrote the Heredity. How you became a poet's a mystery. Wherever did you get your talent from? I say, I had two uncles, Joe and Harry. One was a stammerer, the other dumb. Though they were always being brought up near them and with a father who was very inarticulate, made me hunger for articulation at its most ceremonial, which is poetry, but also for other languages, other forms of expression. So I threw myself into learning Latin and Greek as a way of finding eloquence.
You didn't leave hold of the dialect?
No.
You're still speaking the dialect at school, or was it something you were then writing in, but at school you'd modulated it to so that you didn't annoy the teachers all the time, as we often were told you did?
I had to modulate it a bit in the classroom. Yeah. I had that teacher who was always in that I have in Them and Us, which I can read if you like. Thanks. Them and Us. Aye, aye. Aye, aye. Stutterer Demosthenes. Gob full of pebbles out shouting seas. Forwards only of me heart aches. Mine's broken, you barbarian T.W. He was nicely spoken. Can't have a glorious heritage done to death. I played the drunken porter in Macbeth. Poetry's the speech of kings. You're one of those Shakespeare gives the comic bits to. Prose, even poetry. All poetry, even Coley Keats, you see, has been dubbed by us into RP. Received pronunciation. Please believe us. Your speech is in the hands of the receivers. You say us, not us, T.W. That shook my trap. I doff my flat A's as in flat cap, my mouth all stuffed with glottals, great lumps to hawk up and spit out. Enunciate! So write your buggers then, we'll occupy your lousy leasehold poetry. I chewed up literature and spat the bones into the lap of dozing Daniel Jones. Dropped the initials I'd been harried as and used my name and own voice. Uz, uz, uz. Ended sentences with by, with, from, and spoke the language that I spoke at home. R.I.P. R.P. R.I.P. T.W. I'm Tony Harrison, no longer you. You can tell the receivers where to go and not aspirate it. Once you know Wordsworth's matter, watter are full rhymes. Us can be loving as well as funny. My first mention in the Times automatically made Tony Anthony.
Tony, reading from Them and Us, it's us, isn't it, Blake?
Not, it's us.
It's us, not us. Them and us. His defence of language, the language of his forefathers, who he listed in his most famous poem, possibly V, as butcher, publican and baker, is often very pugilistic, isn't it?
It is, and he talks about these two uncles, one a stammerer, the other dumb, who inspired him. Again, a reminder that, you know, poetry doesn't come easy, especially to somebody from his kind of background. He was enormously helped by being of the generation who was, that getting a place at grammar school, a free education, a classical education, which is hard to imagine perhaps anybody today getting the same level of education as he had. But, of course, one of the drawbacks was how much it separated him from his parents. His dad was a baker, and a number of poems that dwell very guiltily on the gulf that's opened up between him and his mother and father.
Just tell us, talk a little bit more about V, because it's a long time ago now. It was broadcast on Channel 4 in 1987. It's one of his film poems, and he always describes them as film poems.
Yeah, and I mean, one would like to see some of these film poems getting an airing again, but probably V is the most famous of them, partly because it stirred up such controversy. We had Tory MPs demanding that Channel 4 not show this film because of the language. The situation in the poem is he goes to the cemetery where his parents are buried, and he sees a lot of graffiti on the headstones, most of it saying United, as in Leeds United, or sometimes the V for Versuses. Leeds United V, whoever, and a lot of bad language. And he imagines a confrontation with this skinhead, his skin, as he calls him. It's really a kind of confrontation with himself, with his younger self, with who was himself, could be at times, a bit of a vandal.
And maybe he's a bit like Sian today.
Oh, what? Not a skinhead.
And I set you, Sian, this piece of homework, which was to listen to V and to read it, because you, being from Australia and also being hardly born when it was in fact you weren't born when it was broadcast, don't actually know this body of work. And I wondered what effect it had on you, because it struck me that actually it's unlikely that anything quite so strong could be broadcast today.
Oh yeah, I mean, and also the fact that I think when you sent me the link to the film version, and I looked and I said, Claire, is this supposed to be 38 minutes long? And he said, yes.
There was a poem that he did for The Guardian on Hiroshima, which was 9,500 words long, which we printed in full in The Guardian.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's something to be proud of.
Those were the heydays of poetry, weren't they, in newspapers, Blake?
Yeah, and on television. Imagine, you know, all that 40-minute film composed entirely of poetry. Mm.
So, Sian, what did you think of it?
Oh, it was great. It was nothing. I must admit, in the presence of a poet, that I don't read very much poetry, but I really enjoyed this. And just because it was kind of completely unlike anything that I've read in terms of poetry, both in terms of length, but also language, and also how it is a great little cross section for someone who's foreign like myself. It presents a great cross section of a particularly turbulent time in British history, and sort of all these things that it alludes to, and the miners' strike and Thatcher, and
which is ancient history for you.
Yeah, well, it's all the things you kind of vaguely hear about from, you know, way over on the other side of the world, and then actually to get a sense of what it was like at the time to write a poem during that period of time, the anger and how vivid it feels is really something else.
Blake, even in V, which is, as we said, really quite potty-mouthed, it hinges on this painful division in himself. So he says that the skinhead went to spray his name and it was my name there. And there is underlying all this a really difficult, a lifelong struggle, really, with his origins, isn't there? And with his autobiography, which you've touched on already.
Yeah, there is, because he feels cut off from his parents, from his ancestors, if you like, through the fact that he had his education, a classical education. At the same time, I think he honours his tribe, his family, his kinship, if you like, through using their language. There's a lot of dialect, there's a lot of colloquialism. You know, the skinhead says to him, you know, can't you speak the language your mum spoke? But I think he does. And he not only shows that you can use colloquial language in poetry, but he shows you can use politics in poetry. You know, it's no accident that he published quite a bit in The Guardian, that he was responding to news, that he became, having been, if you like, the poet in residence at the National Theatre, he was sort of, for a time, wasn't he, the poet in residence at The Guardian.
In a time that he actually covered the Gulf War, the Bosnian War and the Iraq War. He was a sort of poet in residence in our war coverage.
Yeah, and he believed that poetry could bring something to an understanding of war and politics, that it could be on the front page, that people would read it, and they would gain some understanding as a result of reading it.
But this thing about going back to the more personal side in the elegy, one of the high points of the conference for me was when you did a practical criticism of one of these Meredithian sonnets of his, and it's called Marked with D. And I think we couldn't really do a celebration of Tony Harrison without having one of his poems about his parents, could we? And I just wondered whether you'd read it for us.
I will read it. It's called Marked with D. It's coming from famous patter cake rhyme is what he plays with, put it in the oven market with P, is it? This is marked with D, D for his dad, D for death. It's about his father, who was a baker, and the cremation of his father. When the chilled dough of his flesh went in an oven, not unlike those he fueled all his life, I thought of his cataracts, ablaze with heaven, and radiant with the sight of his dead wife, light streaming from his mouth to shape her name. Not Florence and not Flo, but always Florrie. I thought how his cold tongue burst into flame, but only literally, which makes me sorry. Sorry for his sake, there's no heaven to reach. I get it all from earth, my daily bread. But he hungered for release from mortal speech that kept him down, the tongue that weighed like lead. The baker's man that no one will see rise, and England made to feel like some dull oaf, is smoke, enough to sting one person's eyes, and ash, not unlike flour, for one small loaf. So it's an elegy, a moving elegy for his father, but it's not so much about his death, I think, it's about the opportunities he was denied in life. This is a baker's man who was held down, who was not allowed to rise, unlike the bread he baked, which rose. He couldn't rise in society. He never conquered speech. He was never articulate. There's that awfully moving thing about his tongue bursting into flame, but only literally.
It brings tears to my eyes, that. You know what he's talking about.
Yeah, and I say moving, it's sort of, if you like, slightly grisly too, if he's talking about, you know, the cremation of a body. But all of his sonnets are like this, you know, they play with language, they play with metaphor, they're working at various different levels. Here you've got cataracts as well.
Which cataracts is a sort of standard poetic trope for meaning waterfall, something grand, and actually he's used, it's his eyes.
He uses his eyes. See. Yeah, exactly. The father is not seeing. Well, the son is very clear-sighted, and he's atheistic, unlike his father. His father is consoled with the thought he'll be reunited after death with his dead wife. Tony Harrison doesn't have that faith. He gets it all from earth, his daily bread, he says. But he does not. He's not dissing his father or mocking him for having that faith, but he just feels he's unable to share it.
Well, let's move on to a clip of Vanessa Redgrave reading from another elegy, which is called Losing Touch, and it's in memory of the film director George Cukor.
I watch a siskin swinging back and forth on the nut net, enjoying lunchtime sun, unusual this time of year, up north, and listening to the news at 1:05, as people not in constant contact do, or we'd lost touch, but I thought of you, old friend, and sent a postcard now and then. I knew the sentence starting with your name would end the Hollywood director died today. You leaning forward in your black beret from the Times obituary, and I'd add the background of Pavlovsk near Leningrad, bathed in summer, and good shooting light, where it was taken that July, as I'm the one you're leaning forward to address. I had a black pen poised about to write, and have one now, and think back to that time and feel you lean towards me out of nothingness. I rummage for the contacts you sent then, the one of you that's leaning from the Times, and below it one of me, with my black pen, listening to you criticize my rhymes. And between a millimeter of black band that now could be 10 billion times as much, and none that shows the contact of your hand, the distance needs adjusting just a touch. You were about to tap my knee for emphasis. It's me who's leaning forward now with this. Thank you, Tony.
Vanessa Redgrave there. Coming up, we'll be talking about Harrison's plays, but first, here's a word from our sponsor. So Tony Harrison isn't just a poet, he's also a playwright, although I know there's no just in it, judging by the way that Blake is looking at me. Anyway, I asked Lee Hall how Tony's poetry and stage work stood together.
Well, I think that we're sort of in an odd age where it perhaps isn't common or isn't true that dramatists are not poets, or and that, you know, Shakespeare, our greatest dramatist, was a poet, and certainly the Greeks and the English mystery plays. And so poetry and drama, I think, have mostly in the 3,000 years that they've been recorded, have been poetry. There's been no difference. And I think what was profound for me is that he was essentially the writer-in-residence of the National Theatre when I was growing up. And a poet was writing the biggest plays, the most profound plays, the most ambitious plays that were being written then. And that seems an extraordinary thing. And I think it's an extraordinary achievement sort of now, because you can see how anomalous it has been, you know, that we haven't really followed that up. But I think in the 80s, I think the breadth of the vision that he had, it was not just his poetry and the language, it was a poet meeting theatre in the biggest way, and I think that was very a profound influence, not just on me, but I think my generation. And I think that he had a huge effect on directors and theatre makers, and not just writers, and not just in poetry. I think that those big plays, the Oresteia, the Trackers of Oxyrhynchus, and the Mysteries were the big, huge events of those decades, and they couldn't be more exciting, more inspiring, and they certainly make me want to do this job.
That was Marcia screaming. They ripped off his skin, and all he ever wanted was to join in. Marcia suffered his terrible flaying for a bit of innocent Aulos playing. The Aulos, Athena's flute, she flung it away. So why shouldn't Marcius pick it up and play? A few notes and the goddess gave the flute she just invented the elegant boot. She flung the thing aside. Do you know why? Well, think of the Aulos. Ever had a try? You puff your cheeks out like this when you play. And she didn't like her face to look that way. She thought it unattractive. Well, it's true. Her cheeks looked like balloons when she blew. And who should find a flung flute in the grass but me brother, Satyr, Marcias? Now, questions of cosmetics scarcely matter to one who has the ugly mug of a Satyr. It's not for good luck, so satyrs are noted. So Marsyas blew and let his cheeks get bloated. He took himself off to a quiet bit of wood and he gurned and he puffed and grunted and got good. That peeved Apollo. He'd crossed the bounds. Half-brutes aren't allowed to make beautiful sounds. And can't you just hear them muses say, who gave a common satyr license to play? Music's an inner circle which has to exclude from active participation a beast so crude. How can he be a virtuoso on the flute? Look at the hooves on him. He's half a brute. His one and only flaw was to show that flutes sound just as beautiful when breathed into by brutes. It confounds their categories of high and low when your Caliban outplays your Prospero.
Barry Rutter there performing an extract from 1990's The Trackers of Oxyrhynchus. Blake, he's done so many things in his life. Is he actually primarily a poet? Is he actually primarily a playwright?
I think he's primarily a poet because the plays are all in poetry. They're in mostly in rhyming couplets. So even when he's writing for the stage, he's avoiding prose. But, of course, he is a magnificent playwright, and I think something in particular like The Trackers of Oxyrhynchus, a sensational play, will be remembered for a very long time. Recently revived in a small way, but, you know, a big thing at the National. And he was the National Theatre's poet in residence for many years. And I think it's a pity now that we don't see the dramatic work staged very much. But, you know, it's not too late. I think what he did was to bring to verse drama, which had kind of fallen into, I don't know, I wouldn't say disrepair, but it had been discredited a little after the years of Eliot and T.S. Eliot and Christopher Fry. Harrison kind of showed that verse drama could have guts and balls and be strong and vigorous and energetic rather than the shadow thing it had been with them.
Sian, are you convinced as a newcomer to his work? Will you be going back to look out all this, these things we've been talking about?
Well, I don't have any experience with him as a playwright, but I am very interested in his poetry now, just in terms of the language. Like, I don't really encounter people that use language in the way that he does and captures that sort of, it's a working class voice in there. I don't see that in poetry ever, so I am interested in going back and reading him a bit.
Which works do you think will be remembered, Blake?
I think the sonnets in the School of Eloquence, mostly elegies to his parents, V, obviously, some of the plays. He's still working. He produced a little pamphlet that's just come out and also a collection of his prose works. You wouldn't have thought there'd be much there, but it's a 500-page book, mostly pieces around explaining, you know, about productions of his plays and so on. So, yeah, he will be remembered as one of the great poets of the late 20th century, I think, and into the 21st.
And he's an influence on people like the performance poet Kate Tempest, isn't he, and Luke Jennings.
He is, and I think, and somebody like Simon Armitage would say, you know, he never got started as a poet without the example of Harrison. I mean, Simon Armitage watching V on telly, that was the beginning of poetry for him. So yes, his influence was lasting, I think.
And also his influence, you talked a little bit about his influence on your memoirs. You've written memoirs of your mother and father.
Yeah, in prose, but seeing that one's ordinary parents could be a fit subject for a book, for writing, definitely had an effect on me. So yes, he had his influence on me too.
So he has influenced prose as well as poetry.
And dramatist too.
And dramatist as well. That's not too bad, is it, for 80 years?
No.
And that's all from us for this week. You can find a full recording of the Tony Harrison evening we excerpted on the British Academy website. Many thanks to them for making it available to us. You can find them on www.britac.ac.uk/events. Thanks also to studio guests Blake Morrison and Sian. Next week, she'll be returning with an interview of Patricia Lockwood, author of a new memoir, Priest Daddy. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and our producer, Simon Barnard, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Oh. For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.